Before we begin, a quick warning. This episode includes details about domestic violence. We know this can be difficult to hear, so please listen with care and use discretion if you need to skip or step away. And if you or someone you know is experiencing domestic violence, help is available through the National Domestic Violence Hotline by calling 1-800-799-SAFE or 1-800-799-7233. When people picture Florida, they usually envision long sandy beaches, palm trees, and theme parks. For a large part of Florida, this is accurate. But in rural Polk County, Florida, you see more pickup trucks than convertibles and more cowboy boots than flip-flops. It was in this rural area, Lakeland, Florida to be exact, that 17-year-old Michelle Somm met Leo Schofield. Michelle, local to Lakeland, had a happy childhood until her parents' involvement in the party scene ended their marriage and disrupted her life. Michelle and her brothers ended up in a children's home for nearly 4 years until one day when her father showed up, newly sober, ready to bring them home. By her late teens, Michelle was working, helping her family, and spending her weekends with friends at concerts and skating rinks. She was shy but spirited, with all the complexities of a typical teenage girl. Leo was the opposite of a typical Lakeland resident and different than anyone Michelle had ever known. With his long black hair, thick New England accent, and a kind of confidence that bordered on arrogant, he stood out in Polk County from the moment he arrived. He was a few years older, played guitar in a hard rock band, and dreamed of something bigger than small town life. The two were drawn to each other instantly. Leo described the first time their eyes met as instant lightning. He was captivated. When Michelle began showing up to his gigs, their friendship quickly turned into something deeper. Before long, they were spending every spare moment together, talking, laughing, and riding Leo's motorcycle through the back roads of Polk County. Leo opened up about his childhood, the move south, and his dreams of being a musician. Michelle told him about her family and the years she'd spent growing up in the children's home. They came from opposite worlds, but in each other, they found what they were missing. They were young, impulsive, and completely wrapped up in each other. In August of 1986, after only 6 months of dating, the 18 and 21-year-olds got married. For a time, it seemed like they had the whole world ahead of them. But on February 27th, 1987, just months after their wedding, everything changed. Michelle Schofield's body was found floating, face down in a drainage canal along State Road 33, stabbed 26 times in the back, neck, and chest. Leo was inconsolable. And as the town grieved the loss of Michelle, they rallied around Leo, comforting the grieving newlywed. Their sympathy, though, wouldn't last. As investigators asked around, a darker picture of Leo started to emerge, one filled with control, anger, and violence. Soon, the love story of a quiet local girl and the outsider musician would be rewritten. And a new story would become one of Central Florida's most haunting murder cases. A young wife dead, her husband accused, and one piece of evidence, buried for 17 years, would return and turn this case inside out. The prosecution says Leo's rage ended Michelle's life. The defense says injustice destroyed his. But it's the jurors who have the final say. This is the 13th Juror Podcast, where we break down real court cases and put you in the juror's seat. Two sides, the same evidence. You decide what to believe. I'm your host, Brandi Churchwell. Today's episode is Florida versus Leo Schofield, Part 1, the prosecution story. Before the headlines and the accusations, it was just Leo and Michelle. Two young people from different worlds who somehow found each other in the middle of Polk County, Florida. In the late 1980s, hard rock was everywhere. And for Leo, it became his whole identity. Leo was 16 when his family moved from Fall River, Massachusetts to Polk County. He felt out of place from day one and knew he didn't fit in with the other Polk County kids. The one thing that kept him going was music. And when he found a group of kids in Lakeland who shared his passion for hard rock, he threw himself into it completely. He joined a local band and spent every spare hour jamming in garages and playing gigs at house parties, bonfires, or anywhere that would have them. Their sound was raw, loud, and unapologetic. Everything Leo wanted to be. One of his bandmates, Buddy Anderson, shared his obsession with music. The band practiced a few times a week, but Leo and Buddy played together even on their off days. Buddy's dad, Jim Anderson, was one of the band's biggest supporters. He promoted their shows and turned his garage into a studio. He even helped Leo find extra work during the day. And most mornings, Leo rode with him to job sites. In the evenings, he and Buddy played their guitars for hours into the quiet Polk County night. Around this same time, Leo settled into life with Michelle, but his world began to shift. They bounced around for a while, living with friends, sharing rent, trying to get on their feet, but each arrangement eventually fell apart. Finally, they landed in a small trailer at Island Oaks in Lakeland. It wasn't much, but it was theirs. The kid with the guitar and the motorcycle was trying to build something stable. He still had the motorcycle, but now, parked right beside it, sat a little orange Mazda station wagon. Michelle didn't have her license, but that didn't stop her from insisting she could drive it. They shared the car, often trading off depending on who needed it for work. Leo on job sites, Michelle waiting tables at Tom's restaurant. By late February 1987, Leo and Michelle had been married for about 6 months, and life had fallen into a comfortable rhythm. Work, music, and late nights with friends. On the evening of February 23rd, Leo and Michelle were over at the Andersons' house. Leo and Buddy played guitar while everyone hung out, and when it got late, they decided to stay the night. The next morning, Leo left early with Jim to head to work. Michelle took the car and planned to do laundry at her dad's house, work her shift at Tom's restaurant, and then come back to the Andersons to pick up Leo. When Leo and Jim returned to the Andersons that evening, he hadn't heard from Michelle, but he wasn't worried. Remember, in the 80s, there were no cell phones, texts, or location sharing. Tom's restaurant closed at 8, and he figured she'd be there soon. So he and Buddy did what they always did, headed to the garage and started to play. But by 9 o'clock, she still wasn't there. And then Leo started to worry. Michelle didn't have a license, and she'd already been pulled over once before, so he didn't like her driving alone, especially at night. At 9:45 p.m., the Anderson's phone rang. Leo picked it up. It was Michelle. She was calling from a payphone and told him she'd finished her shift, gone home and fed their puppy, and had put away the laundry she had washed earlier that day. She said she'd made $13 in tips, which she was excited about. So she bought herself a Coke and $3 worth of gas. She even asked if he wanted anything from McDonald's. But Leo, frustrated that she was running late, told her no. He said for her not to stop, just to come pick him up and they could get something to eat together. He told her that he and Buddy were about to ride over to Vince's house and said for her to meet him there. Vince Rahner was a friend of theirs, someone Michelle knew well. She agreed to meet him there. They exchanged I love yous, and Leo hung up the phone. No one knew it then, but that would be the last time anyone heard from Michelle Schofield. The drive to Vince's house from the payphone where Michelle was shouldn't have taken more than 15 to 20 minutes. After Leo hung up the phone, he and Buddy stayed at the Andersons for a bit. And by the time they made it over to Vince's house, Leo was expecting Michelle to pull up at any minute. But more and more time passed, and by 11:30, Leo knew something was wrong. He asked Buddy to drive him around to look for Michelle, but Buddy said he would need gas money to do that, and Leo didn't have any on him. So Leo called his dad, Leo Schofield Sr. He told his son not to panic, that Michelle was probably fine, maybe running late or stopped somewhere along the way. He told Leo to wait a little longer, and if she didn't show, to call him back so they could go look for her together. Leo couldn't sit still. He called the highway patrol to ask if there had been any accidents. Then he called the Lakeland Hospital emergency room. Neither had any record of Michelle. 15 minutes later, he called his dad again. This time, Leo Sr. said he was on his way. And around midnight, he arrived at Vince's to pick up Leo. He told him he'd just seen what looked like the orange Mazda passing by. He thought Leo was driving, even honked his horn, but the car never slowed down. Leo told him to catch up, and although they tried, were never able to find the car. Island Oaks, the trailer park where Leo and Michelle lived, was only about 10 minutes away, so they drove there next, hoping to see the car in the driveway. When it wasn't, they decided to retrace the routes Michelle might have taken, scanning the roads in case the car had broken down. Still, there was no sign of her or the car. So they headed back to Vince's house. When they arrived, Leo Sr. waited in the driveway while Leo went inside and called 911. He gave a description of Michelle and of the car and said he had expected her to arrive hours before, but she never showed up. The dispatcher placed Leo on hold, and the recorded line kept rolling. Leo tells Vince that he's worried and that he can't afford to stress over this because the slightest problem trips him out. He said it's not like her. She was on the way there. Then Leo says he very seriously doubts Michelle is just messing around somewhere. But if she is, God help her. The dispatcher came back and reassured Leo that the information would be passed on to patrol units. And if officers spotted Michelle, they would tell her that her husband was looking for her. The call ended at 12:48 a.m. Shortly after that, Leo got back in the truck with his father and left Vince's house once again. What happened after that has become the subject of debate ever since. From here, the story takes two very different paths. Everything becomes a matter of interpretation and accusation. And 2 years later, in March of 1989, Assistant State Attorney John Aguero and Defense Attorney Jack Edmond would each attempt to fill in those gaps, presenting very different versions of what happened next to a Polk County jury. Before the trial even began, before anyone told their story, there were a few facts no one could deny. Leo and his father left Vince's house sometime after the 911 call ended at 12:48 a.m. By 4:40 a.m., Leo returned alone to the Andersons' house. During those 4 hours, there were two confirmed sightings of Leo. The first was at Michelle's father's house, where Leo told him that Michelle was missing. Her father said she'd been there earlier that day doing laundry, but she left around lunchtime and he hadn't seen her since. The second sighting was at a gas station around 3 a.m. when Leo approached three deputies to ask if they'd heard anything about his missing wife. They said they hadn't. 48 hours after Michelle went missing, the orange Mazda was found on the side of Interstate 4 heading north out of town. The flywheel had come apart, causing the car to break down. The following day, Michelle's body was found floating in a drainage canal along State Road 33. About 6 miles from where the car was found. Those times, calls, and movements are details that aren't disputed. But what happened during those missing pockets of time, starting with the 4 hours that Leo and his father were unaccounted for, is where the stories begin to diverge. Leo told authorities that he was out searching for his wife, what any husband would do when someone he loved was missing. But according to prosecution, that wasn't the case at all. The state's theory was that sometime after Michelle left work that night, Leo confronted her, killed her, then called his father for help. Together, they disposed of her body in the canal where she would later be found and abandoned her car along the interstate. Now, Leo Schofield was to stand trial for Michelle's murder and, if convicted, could face the electric chair. In his opening statements, prosecutor John Aguero told jurors that Leo Schofield was not the quiet, mild-mannered young man sitting at the defense table. He said that image was the farthest thing from the truth. He said that Leo Schofield was a violent man, and that by the time the state was finished presenting its evidence, they would prove, beyond a reasonable doubt, that Leo Schofield murdered his wife. based on the evidence and testimony they presented, this is the prosecution's story. From the moment the state began presenting its case, Prosecutor John Aguero made sure the jury's attention was fixed not just on what happened to Michelle Schofield, but on who he believed Leo Schofield really was. For two full days, the state called neighbors, friends, and landlords to tell the jury about one thing: Leo's temper. They painted a picture of a young husband who, behind closed doors, wasn't the easygoing musician he portrayed himself to be, but a man with a dangerous side. Someone controlling, quick to anger, and prone to violence. It was a deliberate choice. Before Aguero asked the jury to believe Leo was capable of murder, he first wanted them to believe Leo was capable of rage. And by the end of those first 2 days of testimony, a theme had already taken shape. Leo Schofield had a temper and was violent. These were the building blocks of the state's case and the foundation for the story the prosecution was about to tell. It began with some neighbors who had only seen glimpses across a yard or through a window, like Mrs. McClelland, who testified she often saw Leo shoving Michelle outside their home, or the Hawkins family from next door, who said they'd hear yelling and screaming, though they never saw what happened inside. Then prosecutors turned to the people who knew Leo best, his roommates and friends. They wanted to show a pattern, a buildup of violence leading straight to Michelle's death. Leo's friend, Ed Vachon, and his father, George Vachon, both took the stand for the prosecution. Right after they got married, Leo and Michelle had lived with Ed in an apartment his dad owned. Ed said one night he heard what sounded like a bad fight between the couple, and when he opened the door to check on them, Leo had Michelle pinned against the wall. When Ed stepped in, both yelled for him to get out. He also recounted a different night, when Leo, in a rage, stabbed his own leg with a butcher knife until it bled, then stormed off down the street. George testified that Leo could be loving at times, but often hostile, like when he damaged a door and punched a hole in the wall. Even though Leo paid for the repairs, George told him it was time to move out. With nowhere else to go, the newlyweds moved into a small trailer at Island Oaks with friends Dean and Melissa. At first, it seemed like a perfect setup, splitting rent and hanging with friends. But within weeks, things turned violent. Both Dean and Melissa told the jury about the day Leo asked Michelle to bring him a glass of tea in his favorite glass. That glass was dirty, so she used another, something they said enraged Leo. They watched as he punched Michelle in the stomach, knocking her to the ground. Dean's friend, Edward Collins, backed them up on Leo's temper, saying he often saw Leo fly off the handle, yelling and throwing things. He never saw him hit Michelle, but when the tension rose, Ed would find an excuse to leave. Dean and Melissa said when the violence became too much, they packed up and left. Then came Bobby and Mary, who moved in not long after Dean and Melissa moved out. Bobby told jurors he never saw Leo hit Michelle, but when he'd come home from work, sometimes furniture would be overturned and windows would be broken. He said he thought it was because Leo had lost his cool. Mary, who had known Michelle since they were kids, painted a more detailed picture. She said Leo was controlling, dominating, and that their arguments were constant. She described one that started over a football game. Leo was watching the game on TV, and he wanted them to be quiet so he could hear it. But she and Michelle were talking. He got frustrated and told them to shut up or leave the room. And when Mary continued to talk, she said Leo exploded and flipped the coffee table. Plants and newspapers flew off of it. Mary then threw a lamp across the room in anger, smashing the stereo, and stormed out. She said she went next door and asked a neighbor to drive her to Bobby's work, and as she got into his truck, she saw a chair fly through the window. Bobby and Mary didn't live there much longer, but Mary said they did remain friends with Leo and Michelle and would still visit them. During one of these visits, Mary told the jury she heard yet another argument between Leo and Michelle, and what she thought was the sound of Leo slapping Michelle. She told Dean to step in, which he did, and shouted to Leo that he was out of line. Leo left and went for a walk down the road to cool off. Michelle's closest friends echoed similar themes for the jury. Her friend Carrie said Leo was possessive and demanding. And Michelle Truax, her best friend, described the relationship as unstable. She told the jury about a night after Christmas shopping when she was at Michelle's house. Leo had been out looking for them, angry that he didn't know where she was. When he got home, he ordered Michelle into the bedroom. According to Truax, she refused and said she wasn't going to let him hit her anymore. Suddenly, Leo grabbed Michelle and swung, missing only because she ducked. Truax told the jury she heard Leo tell Michelle, "Shut up. I hate you. I'll kill you, you bitch." Leo's friend, Vince Rahner, and his brother, Jude Rahner, said they saw the same temper. They described Leo bursting into Vince's home, furious to find Michelle there having a beer, and him demanding she get in the car. Vince said he even pulled Leo aside after the incident and told him to calm down, to stop walking around with a chip on his shoulder. Even Leo's closest friends, Buddy Anderson and his family, described flashes of violence. Buddy's father, Jim, and stepmother, Anita, had opened their home to Leo and Michelle, converting their garage into a practice space for Buddy and Leo's band. They supported him financially, gave him work, and treated him like family. But both said they'd seen Leo lose his temper. Anita said Michelle adored Leo, but that Leo could be violent toward Michelle. Jim and Anita each described one moment they couldn't forget. Leo kicking Michelle in her backside hard enough that Jim intervened, warning him never to do that again in his home. The state brought in Leo's high school girlfriend, who described a fight years earlier when she said Leo threw her into a bunk bed and hurled a box fan at her sister. By the end of those first 2 days, prosecutors had reshaped Leo Schofield in the eyes of the jury, from a heartbroken husband searching for his missing wife to a man with a temper capable of violence. And with that picture fixed in the jurors' minds, prosecutors were ready to unveil their star witness, a woman who claimed to have witnessed not only the fights, but potentially the murder too. Her name was Alice Scott. Alice lived directly across the street from Leo and Michelle in the Island Oaks trailer park. Everyone in the neighborhood knew Alice. She was admittedly nosy, and the prosecutor even referred to her in opening statements as the neighborhood busybody. After injuring her back at work, she was home most days and nights, watching the world from her windows. She didn't really know Leo or Michelle. She'd never been inside their home, but she saw plenty from across the street, and she noticed everything. Alice lived next door to her sister-in-law, Linda, and between the two of them, plus Alice's husband, Ricky, they described a steady stream of noise and chaos coming from the Schofields' trailer. Loud music, arguments, yelling. Alice told the jury she could hear partying several nights a week and arguments daily. The three of them even described one moment when they saw Leo pull up, grab Michelle by the hair, and drag her into the trailer. But Alice Scott wasn't just another character witness repeating what she'd heard through the walls. She had a story to tell, a detailed one that would become the centerpiece of the state's case. Alice set the scene. It was the night before Michelle went missing. She was laying in bed, unable to sleep. It was late, around 1, maybe 1:30, when she heard a noise outside her window. She got up, walked into the bathroom, and climbed onto the counter to look through the small window facing the Schofields' trailer. From there, she said she saw the orange Mazda pull in. Leo and Michelle got out, went inside, and closed the door behind them. Then came the sounds. Raised voices, a struggle, maybe even thuds against the wall. Alice said she stayed perched on that counter for nearly 20 minutes, watching, listening, trying to make sense of what she was hearing. And then, silence. She waited and watched, not knowing what was happening. And then the front door opened. Leo came out, but this time he was alone. He got into the Mazda and drove away. Alice woke her husband and told him something was happening over there. He told her that she was being nosy again and to go back to sleep, but she couldn't shake it. A little while later, she heard another car. She looked out the window again. Leo had returned. She said he backed the Mazda into the driveway, opened the hatch, and walked up to the trailer. When he came back out, he was carrying something heavy in his arms, something covered, but she couldn't make out what it was. He laid it in the back of the car. Prosecutor John Aguero wanted to make sure the jury understood exactly what he was implying. So he asked Alice Scott directly, "You didn't know that he might be carrying a body out?" Her answer, "No, sir, I did not." Not long after, Alice's sister-in-law Linda came home from work. She worked for a cleaning company until around 2 or 3 a.m., and Alice would often wait on her to get home, watching for her headlights. Alice met her outside and said something strange was happening across the street. Linda later testified about the night she saw Leo put something heavy in his car. But like Alice, she couldn't make out what it was. The next day, Alice said she saw Leo again. This time, he was unloading a large steam cleaner, taking it into the trailer, and cleaning the carpets. On the night of the events, Alice was unaware that Michelle was missing, so she really didn't understand what she was seeing. It wasn't until detectives came knocking days later that she began piecing it all together. She tried to recall every sound, movement, and detail, and as she explained Leo's suspicious behavior to Detective Weeks, the tone of the conversation shifted. Weeks would later testify that it was right then that Leo Schofield officially became a suspect in the murder of his wife. When prosecutors asked if she was certain about what she'd seen, Alice said she wouldn't be on the stand if she wasn't. But by the end of her testimony, she was trembling. She asked the judge for a few minutes to compose herself before cross-examination. And as the jurors sat in silence, the heaviness of Alice's story hung in the air. For detectives, Alice Scott's story was enough to be suspicious of Leo Schofield. But what came next would make that suspicion spread to his entire family. Because when Michelle's body was found, the story of how it was found would leave even seasoned investigators stunned, and it would forever change the direction of this case. According to Leo and his family, after that 911 call Leo made from Vince's house, he and his family spent the next 4 hours driving the roads of Polk County, searching every route Michelle could have taken. When he finally showed back up at the Andersons' home around 4:40 a.m., he was exhausted. The next morning, Leo and his father met with a deputy at Leo's trailer to file a formal missing persons report. From there, they went to the grocery store where Michelle's best friend, Michelle Truax, worked. When she heard Michelle was missing, she left with them, and the three spent the rest of the day making flyers and posting them around town. The following night, there was a lead. A man who'd seen one of the flyers called the number to report an orange Mazda abandoned on the shoulder of Interstate 4. Leo, Truax, and her husband went to check it out, while Leo's father and Jim Anderson followed in another truck. When they got there, they saw the Mazda, Michelle and Leo's car. The speakers were missing and the doors were unlocked, but otherwise it was intact. When police arrived, they photographed it, logged the scene, and had it towed away. To them, it still looked like a missing persons case, a woman who'd driven off after a fight and could come home at any moment. But Leo and his family weren't waiting. That night, after the car was found, Leo and Truax searched the roadside until dawn, walking through ditches and fields, calling her name into the dark. When the sun came up, they went home to rest, but only for a few hours. By mid-morning, they were back out searching again. Leo's father was searching too. He told investigators he'd been working his way south from Interstate 4, driving the back roads and checking every path that might lead toward the woods or the water. Then, on the afternoon of Friday, February 27th, two truck drivers heading north on State Road 33 saw a man waving his arms on the shoulder of the road, shouting for help. That man was Leo Schofield Sr. He told them he'd found his daughter-in-law's body. Deputies arrived within minutes. Michelle's body was submerged in a canal, hidden beneath a sheet of plywood and brush about 20 feet off the dirt path that ran beside the road. At first, it seemed like the heartbreaking end of a desperate search. But when detectives asked Leo Sr. how he found her, his answer gave them pause. Leo Sr. told them that while driving down State Road 33, he felt a sharp pain in his head, like pressure building. Then he heard something, a voice, Michelle's, calling to him. He said he followed it down through the brush toward the water, and that's where he found her. He exclaimed that God himself had led him there, and even when he saw Michelle's face, she seemed to have a smile like she was glad that he had found her. Detectives didn't believe his divine intervention story and thought it was impossible. How could a man, out of miles of empty canal banks, stop at the exact place where Michelle's body was hidden? To them, that wasn't luck. It was knowledge. From that point forward, investigators began to look at every statement, timestamp, and sighting to build a timeline and theory, not around Michelle's disappearance, but around Leo and his father. What started as a missing persons case fueled by hope was now a murder investigation driven by suspicion. They believed sometime after Leo and his dad left Vince's that night, the couple met up and began to argue. Maybe it was because Michelle didn't show up when she was supposed to, or maybe it started over something even smaller. But this time, prosecutors said, Leo snapped. According to prosecutors, Leo and Michelle got home around 1:30 a.m. Alice Scott watched them pull into the driveway and heard them arguing. The noises Alice heard, thuds, yelling, and a struggle, was the sound of Michelle being attacked. They said Leo killed his wife inside their home, stabbing her repeatedly before carrying her body out to the car, just as Alice had described. They claimed that Leo reached out to his father to help him cover up what he had done, and that at the times when Leo and his father were unaccounted for that night, they were working together to dispose of Michelle's body, driving out to the remote canal along State Road 33. Leo Sr. helped his son drag Michelle's body through the brush, covering her with plywood to hide her from view. After that, the two men abandoned her car along Interstate 4, stripping the speakers to make it look like a robbery, and left. They drove around to create an alibi, first going to Michelle's dad's house, then stopping at a gas station around 3 a.m. to talk to police. They called to report Michelle missing to further craft what the state described as a carefully constructed cover story. And even though they tried to create the perfect alibi, prosecutors argued their actions drew suspicion from everyone around them. Prosecutor John Aguero called a series of witnesses, family, friends, even detectives, to walk the jury through what they saw and heard from both Leo and his father in the days surrounding Michelle's death. It started before Michelle even went missing. Leo's parents were planning to move back to Massachusetts, and several people testified that Leo planned to go with them, but not with Michelle. Her best friend, Michelle Truax, remembered Leo saying he loved Michelle, but didn't want to be married anymore and wished she would just leave. After Michelle vanished, Leo made comments that, in hindsight, raised suspicion. He told friends he just knew something bad had happened, that she was probably dead, and that he hoped she hadn't ended up in water. He even said if police didn't find her soon, he'd have them drag the lake. Jim Anderson testified that the morning after Michelle disappeared, Leo still went to work with him, an hour and a half away, but wanted to leave soon after arriving, saying he had a bad feeling and needed to go home. When Jim refused to leave, Leo stormed off down the road. Jim said he found him minutes later, angry and silent, and drove him back to his father's house. The most unsettling testimony came from Michelle Truax. She said that not long after Michelle was found, Leo told her he might have blacked out and done something terrible without remembering. Weeks later, he suggested they should be together, saying Michelle wouldn't want him to live alone and that she'd want him to be with her best friend. Within weeks, Leo was seeing another woman named Susie. Friends said he seemed to move on quickly, going out, flirting, acting carefree. When he later left for Massachusetts, he called Jim Anderson asking for money to come back to Florida with yet another girlfriend. Jim refused. Detectives also took note of Leo's behavior. When he and his father filed the missing persons report, Leo hardly spoke. His father did most of the talking. Leo couldn't even recall Michelle's birthday, which was only a day apart from his own. When police visited the Schofields' trailer, Leo Sr. became defensive as they looked around, insisting they not go through his son's things. They returned the next day, and Leo refused to come to the door. A search warrant was issued, but by then, the family had already moved back to Massachusetts. In a shed behind their home, police found handwritten notes, drafts of the Schofields' version of what happened the night Michelle disappeared. To detectives, it was a pattern. Strange behavior, conflicting accounts, and two men who seemed to be managing the narrative. Suspicion, once focused on Leo, now included his father. But suspicion alone doesn't prove guilt. It takes evidence, and prosecutor John Aguero was ready to deliver it. One by one, he called witnesses to connect the dots, people who claimed to have seen Leo, his father, or their truck near Michelle's abandoned Mazda. The first of these witnesses was a man from Ohio visiting Florida. He testified that he was driving in the area of State Road 33 and I-4 one night around 9 p.m. when he saw two dark-haired men walking out of a wooded area. Nearby was a light-colored pickup truck with a camper shell, just like the one Leo Schofield Sr. drove. The next afternoon, passing through the same stretch of road, he saw police cars everywhere. And later that night, when he opened the newspaper, he froze. A young woman had been murdered and found in that exact spot. Mary and Randy LaFoon, a husband and wife newspaper delivery team, described a similar scene. Between 3:30 and 4:30 that foggy morning, they were driving along State Road 33 when they spotted an orange Mazda parked on the shoulder. Behind it was a small blue pickup truck. They thought about stopping, assuming the car had broken down, but seeing the truck already there, they figured help had arrived, and they kept going. To prosecutors, those sightings were pieces of the same puzzle. Leo Schofield Sr.'s truck, two men, and the same stretch of road where Michelle's body was found. It wasn't coincidence. It was connection. Eyewitness accounts can only go so far, so prosecutors turned to forensics next. Crime scene technicians processed three main areas: the car, the trailer, and the canal. Inside the orange Mazda, investigators searched for trace evidence: fibers, hairs, blood, and fingerprints. They collected vacuum sweepings, a few hairs, a Downy bottle with what appeared to be blood on it, and a small square of carpet cut from the cargo area. Testing later confirmed there was blood on that carpet, and it matched Michelle Schofield's. Inside the trailer, luminol testing revealed several areas that reacted as possible blood. Samples were taken and sent for testing, but results went no further than presumptive indications. At the canal, investigators found blood on the sheet of plywood and Michelle's clothing. Her jacket, discovered about 9 feet away, was saturated with blood and pierced by multiple stab wounds in the back. In the soil nearby, they found blood. Michelle still had two rings on her finger, which were collected during her autopsy. When Detective Robert Weeks, the lead investigator, took the stand, he told jurors he didn't believe Michelle was killed at the canal. There were no signs of a struggle, just tire tracks, footprints, drag marks, and scattered blood. He said the evidence pointed to the trailer as the murder scene. Weeks testified that Leo killed Michelle inside their trailer, loaded her body into the Mazda, and with help from his father, dumped her in the secluded area off State Road 33, a spot locals called Lover's Lane. He said Leo borrowed a steam cleaner to erase the evidence, and that Alice Scott's testimony fits this timeline perfectly. Detective Weeks' testimony completed the state's story: a violent marriage, a late-night fight, and a father and son who, together, covered up murder. With that, the prosecution rested its case. After 2 weeks of testimony and nearly 50 witnesses, the state made its final plea. Prosecutor Aguero stood before the jury and reminded them of neighbors who heard fights, friends who saw Leo's temper, and a father who claimed divine voices led him to a body. He pointed to the blood in the Mazda, the presumptive positive traces in the trailer, and a trail of behavior that revealed who Leo Schofield really was. Aguero told jurors that Leo built himself an alibi, using his parents to look like a desperate husband instead of a guilty one. Then he delivered the line meant to linger in their minds. who had enough violence, enough rage to stab this woman 26 times? Who is this violent? Leo Schofield is this violent. He told the jury the Schofield family wasn't credible. His father lied about how and when he found Michelle's body, and Leo himself lied about everything in between. Together, their stories were inconsistent and rehearsed, a cover-up disguised as concern. Aguero told jurors that while Leo was calling friends and pretending to search, his father could have been miles away disposing of Michelle's body. He looked each juror in the eye and said it all added up. The arguments, the blood, the timing, the lies. And what it added up to was guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Michelle Schofield hadn't died at the hands of a stranger. She died at the hands of the man who claimed to love her. And he asked the jury to find Leo Schofield guilty. But before jurors could decide Leo Schofield's fate, the defense had a story of their own to tell. Next time on the 13th Juror podcast, the defense dismantles the state's theory piece by piece. Their central argument, timelines don't lie. And if the timeline is right, then the dramatic testimony of star witness Alice Scott couldn't be, because Leo Schofield couldn't have been in two places at once. Just when it seemed the case was settled, came the twist no one saw coming. Four fingerprints lifted from the orange Mazda would finally be identified, and the shocking results would vindicate one side, destroy the other, and 3 decades later, ignite a confession that no one saw coming.